Welcome to the Catchcast. In this edition, one of Britain's most celebrated DJs. How did his interest in dance music begin? What's the enduring appeal of house and trance? And where can you see the king of UK trance anthems perform right here on the Isle of Wight? Today, we are most honoured to speak with Dave Pearce. Welcome to the Catchcast, Dave.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
We're all good. Dave, I got to ask you, if you don't mind me saying, you have been, well, at the absolute top of your game for longer than some people have even been working. And we'll speak about all those amazing achievements in a minute. But I wonder if I can just ask you first, when did your love of music and radio begin?
Well, it started very, very early. When I was a sort of young child, I had really bad asthma and lots of weird medical things. So I spent a lot of time at home in bed rather than at school. And I had one of those little transistor, I mean, this is a long time ago. There was these little things called transistor radios that were about the size of your hand. And I used to listen to stations like Radio Luxembourg and Radio Caroline fading in and out on my transistor radio. And I kind of fell in love with radio, and it felt like it was a friend, and it introduced me to lots of great music. I think that was the beginning of it. And then I also started collecting records at a very early age. And so when I was invited to someone's house or whatever, they always wanted me to bring my records along. So I think that's where the kind of idea of DJing came from.
And when did you first notice that there was certain bits of music that had a bit of a beat to them? I'm guessing, was it things like, I don't know, Donna Summer and Grandmaster
Flash?
Yeah,
disco, or, you know, yeah, the whole disco era was just unbelievably amazing. It was just such joyous music. I was like, oh, I can't wait to be old enough to go to a club. There was a great DJ called Greg Edwards on Capital Radio in London, and he used to do a show live from the Lyceum Ballroom, and it was like an outside broadcast, but from a club. And oh, I used to listen to that, and I was like, oh, I really want to go one day. You know, all that energy music, the whole kind of disco scene was just fascinating to me. And things like Sylvester, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real, and all of that.
Apart from Greg Edwards, there wasn't really much dance or club music on the radio during the 70s and 80s. Wasn't there Robbie Vincent on Radio London on a Saturday morning or something?
Yes,
well,
Robbie was on Radio London, and you know, he was a great broadcaster. And that was one of my first sort of steps into radio, was working at Radio London. I managed to get involved in various things there, and I ended up working on his Saturday show, actually answering the phones and making him tea. And so it was brilliant. So I got to meet lots of my idols, from George Clinton to Womack and Womack to Stevie Wonder, just about everybody really, working on his show. And yeah, he was a real pioneer as well.
You said you were waiting for that time when you could go to a club. Can you remember some of the first few clubs you went to and how old you were?
Yeah, well, in those days, you didn't have ID. You know, nowadays, it's a bit more difficult for young people to go when they're not technically old enough. But in the old days, it wasn't really like that. As long as you kind of pulled it off, you might get in. So I think the very first proper club I went to was the Embassy Club in London. You know, when I was at school, a friend of mine, his older sister was a hairdresser, and his boyfriend managed to get these tickets to this club. And that was in the West End. It was terribly exciting. So that would have been in the disco era, and I was probably 15, if that's the first memory I have really of going to one.
I know you said you took your records to your friends' houses, but when did you start mixing tunes together and play out in public?
From a very early age, I had one of those tiny little record players. And then a friend of mine, his older brother had a DJ console, if you've ever seen a mobile disco, you know, it's two decks and a little mixer. And he stopped using it, and so they very kindly let me borrow it, and then I had it around my house, so I'd play around with that. And my mum and dad used to like to throw parties, so they used to get me to play music for their friends. Well, I was in my bedroom, and it was wired downstairs. I wasn't in the room with them, but provided the music. And then, again, at quite an early age, when I was still at school, I started doing pirate radio, and we used that equipment to record the shows.
Was it Radio Jackie that you first broadcast on?
Yes, Radio Jackie was one of the first sort of big land-based pirate radio stations in the UK, in southwest London. And I started out, as you had to kind of earn your stripes, so you had to be prepared to do all the donkey work. So my first sort of role there was helping guard the transmitter. The transmitters were in various fields, and they were run by car batteries, and you had a little crew around the transmitter. The shows were all recorded on tape, and you had to switch the tapes over, but also you had to be prepared to look out if the police turned up to try and dismantle the transmitter and scatter the evidence as best you could. So that was quite exciting. And then because I did that for a while, they gave me a show And I gradually sort of learned how to do it. So, yeah, I used to do the first show, the like early breakfast show on there.
Oh, and what sort of music did you play on there?
It was a mixed bag, really. I'm pretty sure there wasn't a playlist as such, probably with some core records. But, yeah, I mean, I was playing disco on there for sure, you know. I remember playing stuff like Catherine Hunt, Can't Fake the Feeling, and all those sort of records back in the day. And, in fact, Radio Jackie did have a couple of dance shows on there as well. Would have been the disco era. There was a guy called Brian Anthony, who was an amazing character. He used to run a record shop in Wimbledon, and so it was great. So I used to get records off him because he had all the imports coming into the UK.
That made it a bit easier if you had a good relationship with a record shop owner.
Exactly, yeah.
I believe you set up your own pirate station as well at some point.
I did, yes. I set it up with a couple of friends and we ran it out of a place called Claygate in Surrey. There was a big hill there and there was a very tall tree. And this was on FM, this one, so it was a different sort of transmitter. But we managed to get a really good signal out for miles, just running off this little transmitter. And we used to record the shows mainly at home. But at school, I got them to set up a little radio project in an area where they had like technical stuff and everything. So in the end, we started recording shows when I was at school as well. So sometimes you'd hear the bell going off in the background when we were supposed to be going to lessons. But yeah, that was all good fun.
And I think it wasn't long after you left school that you got your first international gig. Didn't you go to India?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I actually auditioned for it when I was 16. There was an advert in the London Evening Paper, the Evening Standard, saying DJs are required to work abroad. And I was like, hating school, really wanted to get out in the world. And I thought it would be somewhere like Spain or something like that. Anyway, I went to this audition in the West End and this very nice Indian couple were in charge of it. And I did an audition and then they offered me a job, so I went home to tell my parents. And luckily, by the time they wanted it to start, I was turning 17. So I'd never really done, you know, like proper high-profile DJing or anything like that before. And so I was kind of learning on the job, a bit scared. And obviously going to India by yourself at that age was quite exciting. It was called Studio 29, and they were catering for the Bollywood community. And it was sort of based on the idea of the people that would go to Studio 54 in New York and go to Tramps or whatever in London. So it was a very kind of like upmarket set. And, you know, it was great. And then we did Bollywood parties as well. They set up a kind of mobile unit. And so we used to go to film launches and stuff like that as well. So it was really, really exciting and such an eye opener to go to India. You know, I really knew nothing about the country and obviously it was such a conflict scene, the incredible poverty there was on the streets then, along with, you know, meeting these sort of millionaires and people that were a million miles away from anything I'd experienced before. So it was quite a spiritual journey, actually, very intense and very exciting.
Wow, what an incredible start to your DJing life. Dave, you got your first BBC gig in, I think it was 1984. How did that come about and what was the show?
Okay, so I'd been doing pirate radios, we discussed, and there was a little point when I was sort of working behind the scenes at Radio London, what was called a programme assistant. So basically you had to drive the desk, the mixer, for various shows, like especially talk shows and news shows and stuff like that. But I was still doing pirate radio at the same time, so I had to kind of stop that. And the first kind of proper show I got was called The Funk Fantasy. And that was because Tony Blackburn was doing a new event called the Radio London Soul Night Out. And the idea was that each week it would come live from a club and he would be there. And they wanted a show to go on before it and get everyone in the mood. So this was like, I guess, the tail end of disco, the beginning of the whole jazz funk scene. So that was a show that I first did. And luckily, it went really well. And so then I persuaded them to give me a hip hop show, which became the BBC's first hip hop show. And that was called A Fresh Start to the Week. And I was able to play, you know, a lot of this new music that was coming out of America that I found really exciting at the time.
Right, so the hip-hop scene was burgeoning in the early 1980s and the tunes were coming in, well, I suppose pretty thick and fast.
Yeah.
But can you tell us a little bit about that scene and how you were involved and who you met?
Yeah, well, it was really exciting. I went to New York quite early in the early 80s and I remember on my first trip there, that's when hip-hop really made a whole different sort of sense to me because I just felt it on the street. It was this new, exciting music. It was only getting played on a couple of shows. There was a radio station called WBLS and Kiss FM in New York, and they had specialist shows playing the hip-hop. So it was still kind of underground in the city, but you could just tell it was bursting to get out on the street, and I immediately saw that, and I just saw the potential of what it could become. So what I used to do, I think even on my first trip, I got to know as many people as I could, went to lots of clubs. In the old days on records in America, they used to have the phone number of the record company on the label. The early hip hop labels were all like run out of tiny little offices with maybe two or three staff. So I would go in a phone box and ring them and say, "Hey, I'm this DJ from England. Can I come and see you? You know, how can I get you to send me records?" They go, "No way, you're from England, come over." You know, and I'd go around New York, get to meet all these people. And that's how I got to meet the likes of Russell Simmons, who ran Def Jam, and Tom Silverman, who ran Tommy Boy Records. And that's how I became friends with a lot of these people. You know, because I created the show, they were getting their records played on the radio in London. And the whole thing just kind of blew up, really. The station gave me a four-week trial with it. It just went mad. So within about a year, you know, we were doing concerts. You know, I did the Def Jam tour with Public Enemy and Run DMC and Houdini and LL Cool J and all those kind of things. And, you know, it was a really, really exciting time.
Crikey. And while all that was happening, there was just the beginnings, I'm guessing, of these very first house tracks coming out of places like Detroit and Chicago and New York.
Yeah.
When you started to hear those coming through as well, what was your feeling about them?
It was just really exciting. It's hard to explain. The energy out of America, the music was just so brilliant, and it just totally fitted London. You know, there's a real music culture connection, particularly between London and New York. And those records, those early house records, were very similar to the early hip hop records because they were all done on 8 or 16 track recordings. They were very rough and raw, you know, and these were basically kids who'd saved up to get in a studio, and they, you know, they had hardly any time to cut a record. And I think the rawness of it just gave it this edge. The total opposite of like what pop music was at the time, when people were going into these huge recording studios and spending months making a record. This was like so different, so raw, so edgy. So in a similar way, I got in touch with the labels over there. I got to know Rocky, who ran DJ International, which was the premier house label in Chicago. And so I used to get their records over there. And I was lucky enough when Frankie Knuckles made his first trip to the UK. Yeah, I did the first interview with him, and I used to go and see him and DJ in New York at the Sound Factory. So yeah, it was great. So then my Thursday night show then became kind of house as house evolved, and the two ran in parallel. And then when the rave era came along, the two were quite entwined, really, because at a rave you'd have some hip hop being played and you'd have house and acid house. So it was a real sort of melting pot.
I'm going to go off on a tangent here. You made all this sound relatively easy. I know a lot of it was completely hard work, but I wonder if you could give any advice for young people wanting to get into similar fields. How tough is it for them to get into radio and DJing and become a success? Who were your mentors?
Okay, well, it is quite tough, but you have to have a lot of resilience and persistence. I think knock on lots of doors. That's what I did. And you'll get so many knockbacks, but occasionally you'll get people that let you in. You know, when I was at Radio London, I remember when I was getting established, Toby Anstis writing me a letter as a schoolboy saying, "Oh, is there any chance I could come and get some work experience?" You know, and we were so impressed by his letter, we invited him and quite a few actually people that ended up working in radio that I made sure that, you know, when I heard about them, if I thought they were any good, then we kind of got them in and helped them on the way. So there is a, you know, I think the community in radio certainly is one where there are people that will welcome people if they think they've got real drive and potential. But I'd spent years making tea and being a dog's body, basically, which didn't bother me at all because all the time I was learning, watching in the studio, working with different presenters, learning what things go really well and what things can go wrong, and watching how the audience reaction was. In the old days with phone-ins, you'd see all the phones light up or not, so you knew what things were working, and that you just sort of have to assimilate all that information, really. And for DJs, I would say you have to totally be across social media. Now it's a different world. You have to own that creative ways of getting your message out there in a very crowded market. So radio isn't the driving force that it once was in that. It's more about social media now, doing podcasts, being on all of that.
But you've got to be prepared to put the hours in. That's the issue.
Hours and hours. Yeah, hours and hours with no money. I mean, when I was doing my hip-hop show, to give you an example, I was being paid £30 a week by the BBC. I was spending considerably more than that on the records. So I never made any money out of it, even right at the end. And those guys I mentioned in the earlier part of the interview that I befriended in New York, some of them became like billionaires. So, you know, that's how it is.
Now, look, going back to your achievements, Dave, what role did you play in Urban Records?
Okay, so Urban Records was an offshoot of Polydor. So Polydor had artists like James Brown, Roy Ayers, and all these incredible artists. So obviously, being an avid fan of that, I was excited to be offered a job as an A&R man. So an A&R man tries to find new artists for the label and develop new talent and new ideas. So when I joined, it was a very transient time in terms of music, because suddenly acid house arrived at, like, almost overnight, and these new music genres suddenly came along, like the house thing and everything. So it was a totally different model than they were used to, and a different way of dealing with artists as well, because you weren't dealing with, say, a traditional soul artist that had like a long history of writing songs and making music. So, you know, it was a really exciting time. It meant that I could go to New York a lot. It meant I could go and meet James Brown, you know, who was like a god to me. You know, I was very proud to work at the label, did the first big acid house album with them, which was called Urban Acid, and did some exciting stuff.
It was an exciting time, and you mentioned raves and acid house, and people used to drive for miles to get to these things.
Yeah.
For people who never lived through that, just kind of how mad was it all? Or did you ever get into any trouble for playing or attending some of those illegal parties?
It was bonkers. So basically, these parties would be taking place outdoors somewhere around the country. And the way that people found out about them was through pirate radio. And it was a kind of like really exciting hype, because they would be an announcement saying, you know, say there's a rave called Biology, for instance, which was a famous one. They would go, Biology tonight is on. Listen for the announcement at 8 o'clock. And then there'd be another announcement. Call this number at 9 o'clock and we'll tell you where it is. And then everyone would get in their cars and rush to wherever. Of course, eventually, police started ringing those numbers and finding out where they were as well. So it all got shut down. But the weirdest one sort of experience I had around that era, it was difficult for me because I was by then on Radio London and I couldn't be seen to be involved in any illegal activity. So I tended to do the things that were indoors, basically. But I did get invited to a Biology one, and I was supposed to be there with Public Enemy and I forget a few others. And we were in the hotel and they were supposed to then come and get us and take us there. But no one turned up. So we never made it. We were like, what is this? It didn't happen. Yeah.
Oh, I remember all the really colourful flyers. There was
were great, yeah.
So much creativity, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was, yeah. I mean, particularly in the acid house thing with those sort of psychedelic images, and that's what we tried to do with Urban Acid and the album that I did, and, you know, we used that kind of imagery on there as well. Yeah, it was a really creative time, and, you know, I used to love going to see Paul Oakenfold at Heaven in London. He used to do a night called Spectrum. I mean, this is in the acid house era. They did crazy things, like they built a maze one night in the middle of the club, and it was totally black inside, and then there were strobe lights in there. So once you went in there, you couldn't work out how to get out because you're blinded by the strobe lights. You couldn't see anything. It was completely mad, but it was just such an exciting time. You did feel that you were part of something very unique and new, and there was lots of great characters and lots of mad people you'd meet. And what was interesting about that time is that it was all different age groups. You know, you'd get young people 16, 17, 18, and you'd get 65-year-old ex-hippies, whatever, that suddenly discovered this and thought, I'm going to go to this. And everybody was welcome. It was like, it just brought people together. And, you know, it's been documented, I think, pretty well as well, how it brought black and white together, it brought gay and straight together. It was a real kind of unifying experience, really. It was brilliant.
Yeah, it was our kind of Woodstock, really, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Now, moving on a little bit, that you mentioned the pirate stations. There was one called Kiss.
Yeah.
They gained one of the IBA's incremental licenses in 1990. How did you get involved with them and what shows did you present there?
Okay, Radio London suddenly became GLR because the BBC's decided to rebrand it. They changed it back to Radio London now, a few million pounds later. They actually kept me on, so that was good. But GLR was very much a rock-focused station, and although I loved and respected lots of the DJs on there, like Janice Long and Johnny Walker, it wasn't a station that was really playing my music, so I was a standalone, if you like. And Kiss was applying for their licenses. A few other stations were applying, and I met the Kiss guys. and talked to them a lot about their ambitions and what they wanted to try and do. So I actually went on their license application, which obviously didn't go down very well with BBC. So I sort of declared my interest that I would be a key member of that. And, you know, no one knew if it was a ploy by the authorities to get rid of the pirate stations or if they would ever grant one. And they gave the first license to Jazz FM. So we were like, oh, that's it. We've all been turned over. But luckily we did get the license. Very happy. I started on the station doing the drive time show. And then eventually I ended up taking over the breakfast show when Craig Charles left, and I took that over. And no one could quite believe I was doing a breakfast show because I am not a morning person. So sometimes I'd stay up all night. And we did pretty well with it. So that's when Radio 1 got in touch, when the breakfast show was doing well.
Now, by the early 90s, house was then massively in the ascendancy. But there was also a sound evolving which ended up being called trance. I wonder if you can talk about some of your early experiences and thoughts about trance music and how that became part of your life.
Yeah, it was really exciting, actually, because the early 90s was a great period of new music and ideas. And as you say, you know, we had the rave era and all of that going on, and house music going through. We had beginnings of sort of people experimenting with UK garage ideas. But also out of Europe came this new music called trance. I don't think it was even called trance at that point. It was just this different sort of music that I was hearing coming out of Belgium and Holland. And I was just intrigued by it. I'd always loved synths. I remember as a kid, you know, loving like all the Human League and all that sort of stuff. I'd loved the synths. And then, you know, records like Age of Love came along and you were just like, wow, what is this? So I started, you know, incorporating some of those kind of sounds into my sets. And then really for me, the trance thing really took off a bit later at about kind of mid-90s, 95 probably. And then it just exploded towards the tail of the 90s. And that's when I really jumped on board because I just found it so euphoric as a DJ, the reaction that it evokes from the crowd and the smiling faces and the hands in the air. You know, I just find it really happy music to play.
Absolutely. I've still got all my collections of that early trance stuff, the Reactivate CDs and those kind of things. You know, we used to say really daft things when we were out clubbing in them days, like if Mozart or Beethoven had been alive in the 20th century, they would have been composing multi-layered music like trance. Does that sound kind of bonkers to you?
Well, there was always a kind of classical kind of influence going through it. One of my favourite records still to play out is the Ferry Corsten remix of William Orbit, Bob's Adagio for Strings. So, you know, I've always loved those classical bits in there. So, yes, I'm sure they would have done. It's getting those little emotional moments where there's a little bit of the record that puts the hairs on the back of your neck up.
We're up to the mid-1990s now, and you moved from KISS to Radio 1. How did that happen, and what did you get up to when you were there?
It was really exciting because I was doing the KISS FM breakfast show, and I was absolutely loving it. I thought the station was wonderful, but it was only in London, and we knew that Radio 1 was starting to change a little bit. They had new management, and the people that were running it used to be my bosses at GLR, Matthew Bannister and Trevor Dan. They were the two people running it. They were the people that sacked me for trying to get KISS FM off the ground. So, you know, the most unlikely people to rehire you. But anyway, they were listening to the show and they were liking what I was doing and they brought me in. And initially, I was doing the early breakfast show. And the idea was that Chris Evans was going to join the station and I would do the show before him. And it was a very exciting time because Chris had so much energy and ideas. And, you know, obviously it was a wave of publicity around that. So we actually got really good numbers. You know, the audience went up considerably. So within a short time, I was offered other shows. Now, when I agreed to go to Radio 1, one of the main conditions was that I would have a dance show, which they didn't deliver to start with. So I was a bit frustrated that my sort of first exposure to the national audience, if you like, wouldn't be as a dance presenter, but as a general presenter. But I managed to convince them when they gave me the weekend afternoon show. I created a new thing called the Recovery Session, which was about midday on a Sunday. The idea was it was a show for ravers that had only just woken up, so a kind of a breakfast show for ravers at midday on a Sunday. And so quite unique in terms of the positioning of what had gone on there before. You know, I think it was previously Dave Lee Travis or something, and here I was doing like house music at midday for people that were getting up and couldn't remember where they were the night before. But luckily that took off. And then one night in a pub is always a good place to try and launch an idea. I pitched to Matthew Bannister, who was the controller of the radio station, the idea of dance anthems on a Sunday night, because on a Sunday, as you will remember, there used to be the top 40. Lots of people used to listen to that and tape it and everything, whether you were doing your homework or whether you were just bored and there was nothing on the telly on a Sunday. And I said to him, you know, after that, there's this great audience, but then there's just nothing on. They used to put documentaries and stuff on. And I said, what about a show for people that have been out all weekend that want to relive the best bits, really? So that was how the idea of dance anthems came about. You know, I was going to fill it with like great big records and then new records that are coming through and just fill it with energy. And luckily it worked. And so I ended up doing that for 10 years. And, you know, it was great fun.
And when you began that show, Dance Anthems, I think it was 1997, wasn't it?
I think so.
Did you have any idea of its possible longevity?
No, not really. I mean, you know, like all these things, as a freelancer in radio, you're just hoping it's going to work and, you know, you'll still be there next year. But we got such an incredible reaction on the phone lines. People just embraced it. And, you know, there hadn't really been anything quite like that before. So it was all kind of new. You know, I had a massive team on the show, all kind of like volunteers. Earlier, we were talking about how can you get into radio. So I used the same kind of tactics as how I'd got in. So when people wrote in and said, oh, is there any chance I could come in and get some work experience? So we had all these people like answering the phone. So we had three studios in operation. The phone lines were going mad. And then I had people in the other studios recording shouts. So when people rang in, if they had a good story, we'd record them and then we'd play it into the show. And then I had another team that were doing what we call tasting callers. So they'd be answering the phone. If they found someone with a wacky story or whatever, they'd go, oh, they'd be good to talk to. So they'd go live in the show. So it was totally manic, full of energy. The way I kind of operated the show, it was on different levels, really. There was the musical element, there was the entertainment element, and there was just the funny stories that people, you know, often waking up the next day not knowing where they were or things that had happened to them and they're on their night out. And so it was a kind of a lifestyle show as well, I guess.
I think I read somewhere that at one point you were getting something like 17 million weekly listeners. That is unprecedented before or since.
Yeah, no, that's across Drive Time and the Sunday Show. Yeah, it was quite something as well with Dance Anthems, because there's the thing called reach in radio, which is the sort of percentage of available audience that's listening. And we had the number 3 show on Radio 1, you know, so that was nice to have created that and have such a loyal audience.
Well done. And you certainly did create a very loyal audience. I want to ask you a bit about the way that house and trance music stirs the soul. I'm thinking of things like, I don't know, how about The Sun Is Always Going to Keep on Shining, Everything's Going to Be All Right from Red Carpet with that beautiful piano building, or those amazing breakdowns sending a shiver down the spine. I'm thinking of, I don't know, Agnelli and Nelson or Ian Van Dahl you worked with and Picotto's Lizard. How does this music manage to stir such emotions, do you think, Dave?
Well, it really does. I think, particularly in the trance, it's the lyrics and the music that goes underneath it. So with Castles in the Sky, I'd been sent that record from Belgium and I'd kind of lived with it for about a year and it was always there and I was like, oh, I must play that out. And I played it one night in Swansea after having it for about 6 months. I was doing a club in Swansea and I needed a couple of more vocal tracks because they were a crowd that loved to sing along to music. I thought, I'll just give this a go, you know. And by the time that it came around the second chorus, they were all singing it, going absolutely mad. I was like, oh my God. And then it just felt really emotional. It just somehow connected. Do you ever question your life? Do you ever wonder why? Well, yes, most of us do. And I think that tiny bit of lyric just touched people. So I always remember, you know, Monday morning on the phone to Belgium, is that record still available? Oh, yeah, we're not really doing anything with it. Okay, I'm going to sign that. And luckily, you know, it became a big hit. But I still play it out now and it still has the same reaction, you know. So I love those kind of goosebumps records that take people on a bit of an emotional journey. Another one is Delirium Silence as well, which I'll never get tired of playing. And I've seen people crying during it where it's just touched them. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing.
Beautiful. Now, what's now called electronic dance music, thank you, America, it involves a huge amount of sampling and remixing, and there's some pretty fairly unlikely artists who've been turned into trance classics. I'm thinking of things like, I don't know, Britney Spears, Every Time, remixed by Above and Beyond, the sampling of Tears for Fears, Mad World in Ethnic Prayer by Havana, even Moby sampling Twin Peaks. Do you have any real surprises, favourite ones, or tracks that you wish had been danceified?
I always thought that Duran Duran's Save a Prayer is something that could probably be a special moment in a remix record, but I haven't heard a good version of that. But yeah, I think that would be one that I would be interested to hear, because I think it's just got that kind of emotional bit in the middle, you know?
Yeah, that lovely little keyboard bit.
Yeah.
Now, wasn't it in 1998 you became the first Radio 1 DJ with a residency in Ibiza?
Yeah.
Give us a few lines about what you think of that wonderful island and why it's so alluring to dance lovers.
Well, I love playing in Ibiza. I got approached by a guy called Dan Prince, who was Tony Prince's son. Tony Prince was a DJ on Radio Luxembourg that I used to listen to all those years ago. And Dan was working for a magazine called Mix Mag, and he had this idea. He was watching what was going on with dance anthems, and he said, you know, how would you feel about doing a night in Ibiza? But you'd have to do it every week. And I was like, blimey, how am I going to fit that in? Because I was doing 6 days a week with the radio, but somehow we managed to do it. And so I did it at a club called Eden. The opening night was terribly exciting. So when I landed at the airport, I didn't really have any real expectations. I didn't know what it was going to be like. And there were these big billboards, you know, as you left the airport, advertising the night. And I remember then we had a pre-party at a place called Cafe Mambo, which is in San Antonio, where people go and watch the sunset. And that was all these posters, and I was getting more and more nervous as the day went on. And I was like, oh my god. But luckily it was really good, and you know, I was still there 10 years later even more tired. But yeah, I mean, some great memories of playing there. And funnily enough, I'm doing Eden again this year. It's now owned by different people, but so it's really weird playing back there, you know, where I was, whatever it is, 20 something years ago. It's kind of crazy.
History repeating itself again. And history repeated itself when you got involved with another record label, New Life. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so when I left Polydor and Urban Records, I set up a little rave label called Reaching Records, which we did some really good records, but they're kind of underground. And there's a thing called a distributor, a company that gets your records into the record shops and warehouses and everything. And they went bust, and we lost all our income. So that was a nightmare. So it put me off record labels for a while. But I was approached by BMG with the idea of maybe starting a label, and a few years later, so I did that and called it New Life. I was in America and I got taken very seriously ill, and it was about the time that we were discussing the label. So I thought, well, if I recover from this and have another chance, I'm going to call the label New Life. And that's why it was called New Life. And yeah, so we set about just signing my favorite records, and we didn't release millions of records, but the ones that we did, we really wanted to give it 100% energy and chance. So Ian Vandell was, you know, one of the big ones. Rui Da Silva Touch Me was our first and only number one, but that was a beautiful record, which I still get to play. And then, you know, the Above and Beyond guys with Ocean Lab and records like that. And then the weirdest one, of course, was Victoria Beckham when we did Out of Your Mind. That was a great adventure putting that out as well.
Even the Seagulls thought that was good.
Yeah.
You've mentioned all these amazing people you've been lucky enough to work with. You've probably got an incredible contact list. Who do you personally really rate or love as some of those best of those in their field, some of your favourites?
Well, I really have a lot of respect for people like Carl Cox, Armin van Buuren in the dance music world. You know, they're incredible. In terms of artists, the greats like Paul McCartney, I've been lucky enough to meet, you know, people like that. What I've tended to find is the kind of real legendary figures that almost scared of meeting tend to be the nicest people, most down to earth. I always remember when I met Paul McCartney in a studio in London, and he went off and made us a cup of tea and got me a digestive biscuit. I thought, what a cool guy. What I tend to find is the new up-and-coming acts that sometimes it goes to the head a little bit. And
just as a complete aside, I went to interview Carolina Hearn, and she was doing her Mrs. Merton thing in the height brilliant. Of all that. And Hookie offered to go and make me a sausage sandwich.
Brilliant. Well, that's it, isn't it? And why shouldn't they? You know, in fact, I remember co-hosting with Victoria Beckham as well, actually before I did the record with her, and she was co-hosting Drive Time with me because we were doing a Spice Girls special. And that was at the height of the fame. She could have been really arse, and she went off and made a cup of tea in our really manky kitchen, you know, as behind the scenes always is. And she was great. So, yeah, it's good to meet really down-to-earth people.
So you're still gigging and presenting radio shows like Delirium. You're going to be appearing at Norfolk House on 2nd of August to kick off Cows Week. Place will be full of clubbers, young and old. I just wonder how the heck house, trance, dance music still has this amazing pulling power. And also whether you have a preference now for presenting shows or DJing out.
Well, what's happened in my life is I've turned more to touring full time, which is great. I really love that connection of seeing people in front of you and seeing the records, actually the reactions that they evoke. So the music of the period that we've discussed is so special that young audiences that weren't even there, you know, I did 90s Fest in Birmingham the other week, and half the audience weren't even, you know, around when those records were coming out, but they found them on YouTube or whatever. They're feeling the vibe of how great that music was. So yeah, I'm just kind of celebrating that now. And I think the gig at Northwood House, you know, I'll be playing some of my all-time favourites. So it's just going to be like a euphoric vibe. You know, I love playing on the Isle of Wight. And, you know, it'd be great to see everybody down there. I haven't been to Northwood House before, but I think it's going to be a great location. And it'd be great to see all the Isle of Wight crowd from, you know, I've obviously played in the Isle of Wight for many years. It'd be great to see some old faces from back in the day as well, and the new ones.
Northwood House is a beautiful venue, and you just can't keep a good tune down.
Yeah, well, they are. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the great records are great records, and really looking forward to it. And let's hope it's a lovely sunny week, but hopefully it'll be good.
Well, can't promise the sun, but the temperature at Northwood House will be phenomenal. This has been absolutely fantastic. The ambassador of amazing music, Dave Pearce, thanks so much for being with us on the Catchcast on Vectis Radio.
Okay, Mark, thanks a lot.
You can find Dave's weekly Trance Anthems live stream every Sunday at 7 p.m. on homerave.tv. Plus, he's on a world tour right now, which includes that opening of Cowes Week. Join us next week for another Catchcast.